Our first speaker is Ruth Pantland. She's here from South Africa, and she's the Regional Administrator of Leader Applicants. Is that correct? Accreditation. The initials are different since I was the leader. I apologize. So Ruth's going to tell us a little bit about the parenting practices and breastfeeding styles in South Africa. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. That's great. Thank you.
Well, good morning to you all. You may have noticed as you walked in that the sign, the name tag there said Gloria Okumuo. I'm not Gloria. I must apologize for Gloria. She was supposed to be here. She's actually from Nigeria, and she had prepared a presentation for you on breastfeeding and parenting styles in Africa. And she has a much vaster knowledge of the rest of Africa than I have. Unfortunately, she did have a personal crisis, and she's not able to be with us today. So I don't think I'm going to keep you busy for 20 minutes, but I'll tell you a little of what I know of breastfeeding in Africa. And why am I up first? Well, I don't have any technology. That's why we breastfeed without technology in Africa. One of the other things we have in Africa, of course, is tremendous variety. And I think that's one of the problems that people in the United States are perhaps not aware of. You have a vast geographical area where most people understand one language and have a similar culture with a few... can I only think of an Afrikaans word? Of Vikings, okay. A few variations here and there. But Africa is made up of a whole bunch of separate little countries. And those little countries have an incredible variety of people living within them. In South Africa itself, we have 11 official languages. And then there are another whole bunch of languages that are spoken in country as well. And that is just South Africa. So variety there is. And each of those language groups has their own parenting practices and their own style of mothering. So, yeah, it's a little bit difficult to come to you and say, well, this is how we do it in Africa. Which bit of Africa, you know? And which person in Africa? Within South Africa itself, and I'm quite sure that in quite a lot of Africa, north of South Africa, there's a strong American influence. All the bad stuff that you do, you export it to us when you're finished with it and decide it doesn't work anymore. So there is, we get those parenting practices and books about training your baby to sleep through the night, and all those interesting things do come our way. They don't have as strong an influence in our country as they do here. There are people who latch onto them and run with them, but they don't become mainstream. So we know about them, but they don't overwhelm us. One of the great things that has happened recently in South Africa, and I suspect in quite a lot of Africa, those beautiful policies that Elizabeth was talking about in her presentation have been adopted in South Africa as official health department policy. Now, I've been in the Leche League 24 years, and when I first started, the health department used to think I was quite crazy. Breastfeed exclusively for 6 months, it cannot be done. How will the baby ever get used to a spoon? I had that. Yeah. Well, now they've adopted those policies. Exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months is recommended by the health department and encouraged. Breastfeeding for up to 2 years and beyond is recommended and encouraged. All those things that you had in your overhead. I thought, yeah, we do something right in our country. And it's been so exciting for me to see that official policy coming through and beginning to make an influence, make a difference in what is being recommended. I work pretty closely with our local health department in our local town, and I'm actually running a peer counselor training session for the primary health care nurses, and they are so excited about the possibility of exclusive breastfeeding for up to 6 months, and they say, wow, can you really breastfeed for longer than 2 years? And I say to them, yeah, sure, 7 years, that's also normal, you know, no sweat. I was asked to mention one or two of the negatives. Of course, we have the high incidence of HIV/AIDS. which does bring with it its own problems. And in the beginning, there was the whole thing about mother-to-child transmission through breast milk, which frightened people off breastfeeding for quite a while. And we had a lot of people beginning to advocate exclusive bottle feeding for little babies for just in case the baby mother might be HIV positive. And that was a little scary. And we did see things taking a dip there. But there's been some wonderful research done in South Africa, and the official health department recommendation is that mothers, even if they are HIV positive, be informed and encouraged to exclusively breastfeed for 6 months. If they choose to bottle feed, then they exclusively bottle feed for those 6 months. One of the problems with recommending exclusive bottle feeding is that many mothers in Africa like to keep their babies close. And they do tend to sleep with their babies as well. And when baby wakes up in the night, even if they're exclusively bottle feeding, they will often give baby the breast as comfort, and they won't think that they're actually feeding the baby. And you get mixed feeding, which is what you don't want, because the incidence of mother-to-child transmission is greater when the mother introduces mixed feeding. If she's giving bottle and breast, she's more likely to transmit the virus to the baby. So either exclusive bottle or exclusive breast. And exclusive bottle is really, really difficult in our culture. But they do tend to keep their babies really close, carry them on their backs a lot of the times. I must admit, the people that I live amongst tend to think of babies as being not quite human, so they don't talk to them terribly much. There's not terribly much sort of stimulation and interaction, but there's plenty of loving that goes on there. Perhaps one of the other strange things, which I don't think happens in all cultures, but the people that I live amongst, when baby gets to 18 months or 2 years old, he actually gets shipped off to go and stay with grandma so mother can go back to work. And grandma is often in a different town. I have a colleague who works with me at school. We're school teachers. And she has just brought her five-year-old back home to live with her and sent her two-year-old to go and live with grandma in a neighboring town. And that's a little bit of a negative thing. I don't know why they do that, but let me tell you, the grandmas enjoy it. And I can see why. I think that's about all that I can tell you. We have every possible parenting practice in our country that you can imagine. But right at the moment, with the support we get from the public health department, I think breastfeeding is on the up. And I think moms and dads are starting to realize that they really can keep their babies close and enjoy their parenting years. Okay.
Thank you, Ruth. Ruth, could you guess at the statistics of breastfeeding initiation then in South Africa? But high, like 70, 80, closer to 90, good. We did find a couple of computers, you guys, by the way. Roz, thank you. We do have two computers with those drives. You've got them as well? I think we now have three computers that can do this. Leave it to women to solve the problem. I just want to give some perspective on the breastfeeding rates in the United States. In 1956, when Wallachia League was started, breastfeeding initiation was just 20%. Can you imagine? In 1972, almost 20 years later, it had only gotten up to 24%. But by 1982, it had made a huge jump to 61.9%. That's when I first got involved in Wallachia League in the 70s, and I remember those first meetings. That first meeting, the advantages of breastfeeding, which now is pretty much understood by the public, was, you know, a revelation to people at that time. By 1990, they went down a little bit to 50%, 1995, 60%, and 2001, 69.5%. Now, the bad news is that the exclusive breastfeeding rate is lower than that. That's still only about 47%. And unfortunately, in this country, by about 6 months, only about 12% of babies are exclusively breastfeeding, and about 32% are mixing formula and breastfeeding. So we still have a long way to go. We've made a lot of progress, but I wanted to put that in perspective for those of us who kind of, you know, aren't sure where things are in the United States. Next, I'd like to introduce Elizabeth Halsing. Am I pronouncing your name correctly? Correct. Thank you. She was our keynote speaker this morning, for those of you who were there. Elizabeth is the Senior Advisor for International Affairs and Public Health for the Norwegian Board of Health. And she was the founder of, and I'm going to try to say this right, Ama Hjelpen. That's cute. That sounded good, though. Not anything like that, but Elizabeth will tell us how that is. That's a mother-to-mother support group that she started. She's the mother of two and the grandmother of seven. Very nice to have you, Elizabeth. Thank you.
We don't have an overhead projector.
Yes, there is. Okay, I thought I'd give you a little bit anecdotal fill out, I would say. Okay. And then there were two rather important pieces of information. Information that I didn't manage to get across this morning, and I would like to, if that overhead becomes operational, I can see I'm losing out with overheads, it's old-fashioned technology. I'm going to start with a totally irrelevant anecdote, but which has its interesting sides. In Tromsø, okay. In Tromsø, which is a northerly town, it's on the Arctic Circle. All restaurants in the town are actually positive to breastfeeding in the restaurant, which is not always the case in Norwegian towns. However baby friendly we are, there are always or it's a rarity that the whole city is positive. Now there were these ladies who had their small babies, were fed up with being home, and went into town, and that was well and good. Some gentlemen began to accost them, and at one stage one of the ladies thought that enough is enough, so she simply pulled up her sweater and she shot at the man. And from what we're told, it was a fantastically efficient weapon. And it also made me think, there is something with breast milk as body fluid, which is perhaps attractive, but also very repulsive to people. So you can always think of the possibility of defending yourselves in that way. We have had much discussion about breastfeeding publicly, because it's we have a rate which is 90% at 3 months. And that means that there is a lot of breastfeeding going on, necessarily.
When the plane is landing, and normally there is a lot of baby crying, it's completely quiet because they're all at the breast. So it's actually a problem for those mothers who do not breastfeed, because there are some, and they may have their good reasons. It may not be what they wanted, and a nurse actually did a study of such mothers and found that they were in a very unhappy situation. One mother told of how when she went into a, what do you call it, a magazine, a big store, and there are usually a room where for mothers and babies, and when she pulled out the bottle, she felt that maybe people thought she had stolen the baby, which I think is in a way tragic. So it's as if when breastfeeding is so common, it has its own set of problems. Do you think you could put the, yeah, that one on first? That's fine. I would have wanted to show this one this morning. What is it? Maternity leave is the green, are the green bars. And you can see in 68, it's from 68 to 2000 approximately. In 68, which was about the time when I had my kids, it was 12 weeks. We had 12 weeks of maternity leave. The red line is all breastfeeding at 6 months, and those striped bars are women working outside home. So you can see it doesn't really come together. There is no inner logic in this. The breastfeeding started to go up while we still had very low maternity leaves. Yeah. And when it was increased to 18 weeks, we had a tremendous jump. Now it's 40 weeks, or it can be 52 at 80%. And it doesn't seem as if that has boosted breastfeeding any further. So I don't think it is these very, they're very generous. And it's a good thing for the mothers to have the long maternity leave. But that's not why they breastfeed. We've also found that there are more women who, more working women who breastfeed than those who don't work. They have lower rates of breastfeeding. If you could put on the last, then that'll be my farewell. Swan song. And what is this? This is what Randa Sabie was talking about. It is a comprehensive infant nutrition policy, and I have used a vocabulary in this graph that is one that you would use in human rights, in the case of it's kept in human rights language. I can say very quickly what it consists of. The roof has two rooms. The left room is assessment and analysis of the situation with regard to breastfeeding. And there are specific types of analysis you do: causality, role, and capacity analysis. To the right, based on the situation analysis, you have obligations. That's to say, based on what you find in the left part, you formulate your right part. And then there are three main divisions in the house. One has to do with the breast milk supply and baby and mother's possibility of meeting physical access to between mother and baby. The middle part, quality, has to do with pollution and with the maternal nutrition, milk quality. And to the right are all those action areas, I would call all of these, that have to do with knowledge, attitudes and practice, the more the house is situated on a platform. That platform has contains all the instruments that a country has at its disposal. These are the tools that for any type of policy a country, a government have. Its laws, its taxes, fines and subsidies, delivery of services, information, research, and then what? Training. Yes, thank you. So this is maybe easier to see, a cleaner version of what goes into a policy. It may be easier to discuss when you have such a model. That's all it's for.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
We'll get her. Okay.
You can keep talking.
Can I in the way? Yes, okay.
Ruth, can you turn off the overhead projector?
Where's that little man in black? Oh, we need that. A woman in white did it. Excellent. Our next speaker is, and we're just going to take a couple minutes to fiddle with these things again, is Dorley Gonzalez. She's here from Mexico. Dorley has been an industrial engineer and consultant. She's the mother of three girls, 14, 12, and 6. And she's been an industrial engineer and has been associated with software development companies. She's taught statistics, computer, and physics. And is that right? So far, so good? I'm making this up? And 10 years ago, she became a LH League leader and is now has been the ACLA. Are you currently the CLA for Mexico? So she's been the ACLA and CLA for Mexico. And is currently working, and I don't know what this is, Dorley, maybe you can tell us, the Review Network and the FAW for the Renewal Initiative. Yeah. Okay, so this is, Dorley can tell us about what this is when she gets up here. Do you want to start? Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Keep talking.
Do you have any questions for Elizabeth or Ruth until we get started with Dorley? Any questions about what's going on in their countries or how they've achieved that? I'll repeat the question. The question to Elizabeth is that why the explanation for why the breastfeeding rate in Norway is higher among working mothers than it is about among non-working moms.
78%. It may have to do with the type of work they're doing. We have not studied that, but we've found that students and women in employment are breastfeeding more. We've had two studies to show that, but it may be that those who go back, that they are in positions where they can decide that, where they can set the conditions, and it's not necessarily the lowest paid or the most powerless. So we think there might be a selection there. If you see. Any other questions to... Okay. Yeah, in 10 words. I think I said why I thought it's gone down. That was really misinformation on a systematic and grand scale. When it turned, I think it had to do with knowledge about how to breastfeed, exactly what do you do when you get this or that problem. There was quite a lot of spreading of problem-oriented, evidence-based material in the country. And my feeling is that that was spread among mothers and among health workers. There was a little bit of fighting between the mothers and the health workers, at least, even though none of the parties wanted that. But there was a bit of competition, perhaps. Some health workers felt that Amir Elpen was doing their job and weren't appreciative of that. So that was the 10 words.
I think this workshop is emphasizing the main component to successful breastfeeding, which is keeping your sense of humor.
Okay. First, I have to thank Peggy for the presentation and Ross for making my presentation possible with this technology. Thank you, Ross. Okay. I'm Doralie Gonzalez from Mexico. I've been a leader for La Leche League since 1992. And I'm very happy to be here and talk to you about breastfeeding practices and parenting styles. For that matter, I'm introducing you to Perla's life. Perla is a regular middle-class Latin American mother. Perla is a professional, and she left home at the age of 33 to marry Efraín. You know, this is a very common parenting practice in Mexico and Latin America. More than 80% of the children stay at home, age 23-35, until they get married. They usually offer financial help to the family. Even if they go out to university, they return and stay with the family until they get married. This is what families expect from them. And as our parents and we did, hopefully our children will not leave home until they get married. That's what we expect. Okay. Now back to Perla's life. After a year of marriage, Perla got pregnant. Perla didn't know much about pregnancy, birth options, breastfeeding, or parenting styles. Only that she would probably be breastfeeding for 6 months. When she was about 4 months of pregnancy, she entered a psychoprophylaxis course, and she got very enthusiastic about the idea of giving birth in water. She went to internet and found out about the Mother and Baby Friendly Hospital initiative for that purpose. Perla found out that there are approximately 1,170 hospitals, friendly hospitals in Latin America and the Caribbean. 41 in Argentina, 2 in Guatemala, 90 in Peru, and 791 in Mexico. The Mother and Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative was promoted in 1991 with the collaboration of government, UNICEF, and OMS. Every country had reported a substantial benefit in the prevalence and duration of exclusive breastfeeding in the last decade. The womaning practice and the elimination of bottles and formula from hospitals have raised the rates of initiation of breastfeeding in more than 90%. In Mexico, 764 public hospitals are certificated. 57 are still pending. In 1994, 284 were certificated. In 1996, the number grew to 548. In 2000, the number reached more than 700 hospitals. Even though the number of certificated hospitals is growing each year, almost every country has reported that most of the hospitals are not fulfilling the requirements. A study made to 18 out of the 90 Peru certificated hospitals shows that only one of them follows the 10 steps. 11 of them follows less than the five steps. An official study in Mexico shows that the information given to the mother at the hospitals is not enough in order to prolongate the breastfeeding longer than 2 or 3 months. It also shows that only 47% has exclusive breastfeeding during the first 6 months. Now, back to Perla's life again. For Perla and Efraín, the 9 months passed quickly, and Ana Guadalupe made her festive entrance to this world by a cesárea. Perla was hoping, you know, for a water bed, but as she expressed, the hospital practices were not the best. Perla wasn't happy at all about the cesárea and found out a worrisome statistics about cesarean practices in Mexico. It shows that number reached 35% from the total. It's high, isn't it? However, Perla started to breastfeed successfully. She was told about the advantages of breastfeeding and got very enthusiastic about the idea. She also found out about another worrisome statistic. In Mexico, there are born 2,700,000 kids per year. 1,600 of them die before they reach 5 years old. 44% of the 1,600 die due to intestinal infection, desnutrition, or severe respiratory infection. Perla wants the best for Anna, and she's always looking for information. She found out that there's a lot of misinformation about breastfeeding. She gets a lot of advices, and mostly from friends and neighbors, because she doesn't have her family near. Perla lives far away from home because of her friend's job. She misses her mother mostly when Amparo is the lady that helps us with the housework, talks about her own family. This is Amparo's family. Amparo, her husband, kids, and kids live with her father and mother along with 3 other sisters and brothers and their families, you know, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. Perla enjoys a lot what Amparo has to say about her way of living, except for the fact that Amparo's mother is the one that rules the house. The practices of parenting and breastfeeding are dictated by her own practices. Amparo's mother and the woman in the family lovingly looks after the grand and great-grandchildren if the mother has to work. This way of living was very common in Mexico and Latin America, but now it reduces to a low-class population. But you know, we are still aware and proud about the unity, the care, the strength and bond of these families. In the picture you can see Amparo at the very left with a purple arrow. She's carrying her niece. At the middle with the yellow arrow is Amparo's mother carrying her great-grandchildren. At the next with a blue arrow is Amparo's niece expecting her second child. And the next is Amparo's father. This is just a part of a huge family, you know. Just a little part. And they live all together. Okay. Perla goes everywhere carrying Anna in a sling. Some of her friends call her Maria. She is a Maria. You can see Marias all over Mexico. They come to the city to sell their handmade articles, like baskets, knitted bags. They carry the children and breastfeed them until they are toddlers or more. Perla thinks that this is one of our saddest, almost lost heritage that hopefully we will bring back again. Perla doesn't feel bad about the friends calling her Maria. On the contrary, she thinks that's a compliment. Perla found out that there's almost a 10% of native people in Mexico speaking native language. Ana Guadalupe is growing now. And one day, Perla got the idea of getting back to work. But she got anxious about it and she looked around to look for answers. She found out that the facilities for a working mother were not the best. Sooner or later, she would have to win Anna. So Pearl is going to wait until Anna wins by herself and goes to school. She found out that 74% of women in Mexico stay at home. And she also found out about statistics about mother occupation. 71% of them stay at home. She was proud to hear that most women stay home to look for the children. She sorrows to hear, though, that the number of mothers working is growing each year. Pearl is not rushing the winning period. She wants for Anna a natural winning. And as she said, while Anna wants it and likes it, and while I'm available, we will keep on with the breastfeeding relationship. Perla found out about the most common weaning causes in Mexico. Mother illness, 7%, baby illness, 3%, not enough milk, 35%, mother decision, 23%, baby rejection, 3%, pregnancy, 1%, nipple problem, 1%, others 3%, medical advice 8%, and working mother 13%. She realized that these common causes are just a lack of information. Perla now is very comfortable about being a mother. She knows there's a bond between both of them that will hopefully last forever. She knows someday Anna will get married and will have to leave home like her and her brother did. But in the meantime, she's going to enjoy the privilege of being a mother. Perla is now preparing herself to be part of La Leche League as a leader. La Leche League of Mexico has 67 leaders distributed in 15 states. Perla knows that there's a lot of work to do to bring back our culture, and the La Leche League of Mexico needs to grow to have an impact on breastfeeding practices and parenting styles in Mexico. Thank you very much. Any question? Do you have any question for me? Yeah, yes. If they get the information on time, yes, they usually do. But you know, the mother and the grandmother usually give like tea and some water, and so if they don't have the information, they usually just ask her mother or grandmother, you know. But if they have the information, they usually do. Hi, Molly. Okay. She's asking about calostro, if its value over there, they think, you know, it's coming very or more and more important for the mothers because of information. Always is about information, you know. But you're right, the calostro, they used to think it was not useful, yeah. Family education, yeah. Yeah, family education and groups, La Leche groups. Yeah. Yeah, mother to mother work, yeah. And the hospital, you know, if they fill the 10 step, the group in the friendly hospital, you know, that's what's lacking from following the 10 steps, the 10.
the groups.
Okay.
No. How the percentage of mothers who gave birth at hospitals, and it's usually at hospital, not home birth. Yeah. Just the very low population, like the Marias, they do at home. Yeah. Yes. How co-sleeping? It was very common. You know, that was a practice forever. But then it came less and less common. But you know, for Marias and the low-class population, you have to be college, you know, because they have no room. So this is like a high people, you know. But they are having more and more information, and we hope this come back again. Yes. I can hear you. Well, thank you. It depends. For people like Maria, it's, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, okay? But then again, there are mothers like breastfeed only 4 months. So you have a whole range. And for example, well, leaders and mothers that goes to our groups, it's reached that age, okay? 2 years, maybe, 3. No. There's no like following up. That's what we need, somebody to follow up. But there's not much people, you know, working in that. Thank you.
Thank you, Dolly. Our next speaker is it, did you pronounce it Roz or Ross? Ra.
Yeah.
Good on you.
I'm having trouble pronouncing it. It's
Roz. Well, it's Roz. It's Roz. That's got you from Australia. And what I know about her mainly is what an incredible technological expert she is. But I also know that Australia has fabulous breastfeeding statistics, and has the Breastfeeding Association there has done some exemplary work. And so I hope you'll tell us about that and introduce yourself a little bit more formally than I have. Will you do that? Thank you, Russ. But in a minute. And we're going to also leave some time for questions at the end, and maybe we can figure out a mic up here so that you guys can come up and be heard a little bit better. Thank you, Russ.
Thank you very much, Peggy. I'm just a little... I'm actually an occupational therapist in my former life, which is probably where the interest in technology comes from. And I hate being dependent on finding a man to fix the technology. I'm good with cars, too, actually. And I'm also, my career path then took me through the birth of, I have one child who's now 18, and I became a breastfeeding counsellor with the Australian Breastfeeding Association, which was formerly Nursing Mothers, about 16 years ago, and I'm still a counsellor, and I also became a lactation consultant, and then I started working for the International Board of Lactation Consultant Examiners, looking after a region which is about half the world, but includes Asia-Pacific, and I travel quite extensively in that area, so it gives me lots of wonderful opportunities to spend time. I'm going to move through a lot of places. I'm trying to do a broad brush here. And I'm just going to apologize beforehand to those of you from all these different Asia-Pacific countries, because I'm going to touch on your countries and show one or two things that are probably not at all representative. So please don't take what I say as representative of anywhere, because it is such a brief touch going through. Because Asia-Pacific is a region of very diverse cultures and practices. Asia includes the very different cultures of China, Japan, Korea, Indonesia and the Philippines, and that's about, what, more than half the world's population, or a lot more probably. And then there are countries like India, Malaysia and Singapore, which are home to multiple cultures and religious groups which have very different practices. And then there are the Pacific Islands, Papua New Guinea, and the multicultural so-called Western countries of Australia and New Zealand. So, you know, I could be here for a year and we'd never get through, how do I pick one culture? So that's why I'm just going broad. And, of course, there is much in common, including the marketing practices of the formula companies, which are much of a problem in many of our countries. It's actually probably not as bad as they are in America, because in many of these countries the WHO code is at least partially implemented, if not not well implemented. There are cultures where artificial feeding rates are or have been high, and then whole generations of women have lost the art and skill of breastfeeding, so they can't pass it on to their daughters. The picture at the top is actually a picture I took in a maternal and child health centre in Hong Kong, with the Filipino maid bottle feeding the baby behind, and the mother and the grandmother sort of sitting there waiting for the appointment. And down below is a lactation consultant who breastfeeding her twins, and then one of the daughters who always breastfeeds two dolls at once. Because that's babies come in twos. In fact, interestingly enough, she did the lactation consultant's exam while pregnant with IVF twins, twin boys, and then 2 years later got pregnant naturally and had twin girls. And for those of you who are lactation consultants, she still managed to recertify, so don't think you can't get your SERPs. There are cultures where breastfeeding practices have been intact for thousands of years, and I've more recently had some opportunity to learn more about the breastfeeding practices of the Australian Aboriginals who are living in remote communities, and I'll be mentioning that a little bit later. But this is a picture actually from a very old book of a group of Aboriginal children, and they've got clay breasts hanging on strings around their necks, and they've got their dolls, and there was a new baby in the camp, so they're all just, you know, having a bit of a play at breastfeeding, because that's what you do, isn't it? And I'm going to divert here, because Peggy tells me we've got lots of time. I have a friend who's living with one of the Aboriginal communities, and she showed some pictures of a wonderful ceremony with the young children where they take them out. It's part of the, not quite initiation because it's much earlier, but with the girls, it's part of the women's business, where they have a little ceremony and they paint white paint on their chests just prior to puberty, and it's all part of reminding them that breasts are for making milk. That's what their functions are, that as you start to grow breasts, these are what they're for. Okay. Mother support groups are, of course, making a vital contribution at the community level. This is a picture in Korea where they're all sitting on the quilts on the floor. But there are actually more and more, we're getting some mother support groups starting up in the Asian countries. I mean, actually Japan's been going a long time, but some of the other, and there's a few leaders in Hong Kong. But there's more, and some of them, they're starting up their own mother support groups. And then the Australian Breastfeeding Association, which is formerly Nursing Mothers, was founded in 1964 and has remained fairly strong. And in more recent years, there's been groups of lactation consultants becoming more widespread and starting to make changes in their own country. This is actually the first group to qualify in South Korea, and we've now got something like 150 lactation consultants there, and we've got 103 doing the exam this year, and we're translating the exam into Korean every year nowadays, and Japanese alternate years. Lactation education programs have developed and grown, and that's been partly fueled by the exam. That one of the things the exam does is it encourages people to get more education, to learn more about it, and that generates the growth of courses and things. This is not the IBLCE exam down here, I have to tell you. It's a post-lactation course test in Korea, and that's how they do it. They do everything on the floor. In Korea, the breastfeeding rates have been very low, but interest is now coming back from mothers. I don't have the figures, but they're still, in fact, very low. It's something like 20% or something. Hospital practices vary from absolute state-of-the-art, wonderful baby-friendly hospitals through to practices that most of us discarded about 20 years ago. But I've heard that health insurance benefits are higher where rooming in is carried out, so the hospitals get a better rate of coverage or something where they're rooming in. And certainly the lactation consultants there are trying to make a difference, and there are a lot of other people, good people, who are doing some work to try and improve breastfeeding, and we're optimistic. And there's just a few more pictures from South Korea. Actually, it was interesting, one of the hospitals I looked at, that many of the women were, in fact, lying on the quilts, just on the floor, like there's virtually no furniture in the room. The women who had cesareans were in beds. It was probably easier, but the rest of them were on quilts. And, of course, that's a lovely place to sleep with your baby. The baby can't roll out of bed or anything. Okay. Japan is traditionally a breastfeeding culture who love children, and the mothers are encouraged to follow. They have breastfeeding methods. Now, not all women follow these methods, but they do have methods. The Okatani method is one of them, and then there's the... Have we got anyone from Japan here? Not today. There's the SM something or other. I've forgotten what it is now. SMC is another one of the methods. It's sort of like, I think the Japanese are attracted towards rules and sort of, you know, this is the how you do it. And La Leisha League Japan has, which is very strong and has got some wonderful people, and I think there's 17 of them here at this conference. They have been trying to move away from those sort of rules, because rules, while they can help some people, can also discourage people. If you think you've got to follow a whole lot of rules, then you think, well, it's too hard, I won't do it. You know, you've got to follow a diet and everything else. And La Leisha League Japan is really encouraging people to follow their own instincts and to be mothering in the style that we all know so well. And there's also a growing group of lactation consultants, and they're supporting mothers and educating health professionals. Singapore is, I've got a picture there of one of the nurseries, and I asked why there were so many babies back in the nursery, and they explained that all the babies have to, even if they're rooming in, they have to come back to the nursery for the paediatrician's rounds, because they tried having the babies with the mothers when the paediatricians did their rounds, but it slowed everything down because the mothers talked to the paediatricians. You can't look at babies with the mothers present because they talk to them and slow it down, and it's not very efficient. So they bring them all back to the nursery. But there are, some people who are doing some wonderful things with breastfeeding. And Singapore is made up of a number of different cultures, and I think the Malays, as in Malaysia, have got the highest breastfeeding rates. The Chinese tend not to have as high breastfeeding rates, but they are working, as everywhere, to increase them. Hong Kong had become a bottle-feeding culture, but that's now changing, and the Pan-Asian Lactation Consultant Association held its first Pan-Asian conference there in November last year, which I was at. They've got some quite active things going. They've got a few La Leisha League leaders there, and they've also got a Cantonese-speaking mother support group, which is... quite strong now, and they've set up a hotline, actually, where mothers can call and get breastfeeding advice, and they set up a public one, so then all the hospitals started setting up their own, and it's growing a lot. And they haven't got any baby-friendly hospitals yet in Hong Kong, but I was up there last year when I was up for the PALCA conference, and I did the training program for the first group of assessors and educators, so they're moving towards, there are a couple of hospitals there wanting to be assessed, so they're moving towards that. Materials say a lot about a culture, and this is a few years back, but these are some materials that I picked up. You know, a healthy baby program, and you've got a picture of a pacifier on the nurse bringing the baby to the mother, and the pictures of bottles. Well, the kangaroos, thank you, know. They are moving forward on that. China, mainland China, is very different. The women were told by the government quite some years ago, basically there was an edict which I'm told virtually said the hospitals will become baby friendly and the women will breastfeed. And there are some advantages to a dictatorship. because there are now almost 7,800 hospitals which are baby friendly. One of the hospitals I visited, there's a picture down here, they had a nurse, there was a 6-bed ward, and there was a nurse stationed there around the clock just helping those 6 mothers. And when I say around the clock, if she had a break, somebody else came in. So there was someone physically present in that room for those 6 mothers all of the time, and all she did was help them with breastfeeding, mothering, massage, bathing babies, showing them all these skills. And they would get that level of support for the first couple of days, and then they'd move on to slightly lower level of support. Of course, in China, you only have one child, so you want one healthy child, and they're trying to work on that now to... they have had a dramatic increase in breastfeeding rates because they're trying to convince people that breastfeeding is the best. The rates tended to be higher in the rural areas and lower in the developed areas. In our culture, you often get the lower socioeconomic groups who are not breastfeeding, and the higher socioeconomic and more educated groups are breastfeeding. In Asia, it tends to be the other way around, and breastfeeding is sometimes seen as a more peasant activity, and bottle feeding is seen as a sign of affluence, that you can afford to do it. And so you sometimes get the sort of reverse picture. There's been another edict passed, I'm told, which is to do with sustaining breastfeeding in the community. It's basically a step 10 edict, which was passed last year by the Chinese government. So hopefully there's going to be a lot of active promotion to try and get women to continue to breastfeed after they leave hospital. So the initiation rates are enormously high, but they need more support in the community. Couple more pictures. This was a wonderful exercise class where the nurse was there and they're all going up and down in absolute unison. The postnatal exercise class. There were fantastic pictures on the walls of this was some warning picture about malnutrition. I asked about milk banking, and I asked if the hospital had a milk bank, and they looked at me like I was crazy, and they said, well, how else would you feed the babies that can't be breastfed? You know, like, is there any other way of doing it? there's a gentleman here at the conference who's got this prototype device for breastfeeding problems, which actually is quite interesting. I think it's what it's doing is stimulating oxytocin. It's a little, I think, electromagnetic device, a little cup that you put on the breast and do something. He doesn't have one with him, but it's interesting. And that's, you know, we need to look at all of these things because we have to embrace that. Well, we don't want to depend on technology, as we know. It's, there are aspects of technology that can be very helpful to us, including PowerPoint. China, of course, has a very strong breastfeeding tradition. On the left is a statue of a woman actually feeding her, probably father-in-law, and the little children are waiting because he's the respected elder, so he gets the first turn, and then a woman breastfeeding a baby and a toddler. Just some pictures of some of the ethnic minorities in China, various parts of China, breastfeeding. India. India has well over 1,000 baby-friendly hospitals. Is anyone here can give me an update on that figure? Nope. And that's been built on 20 years of initiatives to support breastfeeding. They're doing an awful lot in India. The BPNI is doing a huge amount. The girl child is not breastfed as often as the boy child, so in parts of India the decision about breastfeeding is sometimes based on the sex of the baby. And many women in India live in conditions where breastfeeding is a matter of survival. And in the early 1980s, Mombasa Hospital, that's Mombasa is formerly known as Bombay, introduced rooming in and stock-free supplies of infant formula, and the result was from 1980 to 1990, their breastfeeding rates at 6 months increased from 34% to 87%, just by making a few small changes in their practices in a hospital. So you can get some very, and that was basically a forerunner to moving towards baby friendly, you can get some very dramatic differences. Pakistan, I think a lot of you have probably seen that very tragic picture of the mother who was told by her mother-in-law to breastfeed the boy child because she didn't have enough milk for her twins. 56%, these are twins, for those of you that haven't seen it. 56% of infant mortality is in the first 6 months, usually from prolonged diarrhea, and compared to exclusive breastfeeding, infants given water have more diarrhea and significantly reduced weight and head circumference. And that's a happier picture from a recent IPFAN calendar of another woman from Pakistan with breastfeeding two obviously very healthy, thriving twins. Don't look too young either. She obviously enjoying it too. Thailand has had a major breastfeeding initiative since 1992. Many of the people are still living in third world conditions in many parts of Thailand, although the diet, the Thai diet, is generally quite a healthy diet. In fact, it's the most wonderful food, in my opinion. But breastfeeding rates are higher in the rural areas. I actually took my son up to Chiang Mai and we went out to the elephant park and there was the elephant breastfeeding just for me. And I was sort of under their armpits, these breasts hanging down. And what do we hear this morning? That it's closer to human milk than cow's milk, is that right? Elephant milk?
Yeah.
Yeah. But they do it all on twigs and bananas. Thailand has almost all the hospitals accredited as baby-friendly. They've had a massive campaign there. I visited one of the biggest hospitals in Bangkok, which, incidentally, you've probably all heard of the Bangkok traffic, which is notorious. They have motorbike midwives. If you get stuck in a traffic jam and the baby's coming, they send out a motorbike midwife to deliver the baby in the traffic jam. But their practices were really wonderful. Then women returning to work often wean early and often regret it. And this was these slides were given to me while I was there of a woman who was returning to work, and so her mother relactated in order to feed the baby. And her mother was actually postmenopause, and you can relactate postmenopause, I am pleased to know. this is my ambition. I have an 18-year-old son who has... this is a long way off. But her mother cared for the baby during the day, and you can see down the bottom she's actually squeezing out some milk. And this baby is fat. I mean, he's huge. Interestingly enough, they said they then wanted a photo of the mother breastfeeding. And he sees arching his back and pulling away, and she apparently explained that he won't breastfeed from her unless it's dark. Because he feeds from her at night and the grandmother during the day, and he knows the system and that's how it works. So he's got it worked out. In Thailand, the WHO code covers all foods for children up to 3 years, and they also have very active mother support groups and trained volunteer community health educators. Very, very nice system. The Philippines, some of you will have heard of the Jose Fabela Hospital in the Manila slums, which was really the forerunner of Baby Friendly. They saved up to $100,000 US, now this was years ago, which was 8% of their annual budget, and the first year after introducing exclusive breastfeeding for newborns. They actually set up one ward where they had exclusive breastfeeding and rooming in as an experiment, and they abandoned the experiment very quickly because they said, we can't not do this in the entire hospital. You know, it was so dramatic, the changes. Neonatal sepsis sort of disappeared, all these other problems, and abandoned babies virtually disappeared because the mothers all bonded. So it was a very impoverished hospital in terms of facilities, but the care was just wonderful. And it's been used as a teaching model for many different parts of the world. And Bunso is famous for its code monitoring activities in the Philippines, and they've got a very strong version of the WHO code enacted in law with jail terms for potential as potential penalties. Mother support activities in the islands include literacy programs. Aragon, is that anyone from the Philippines here? No, Aragon, I think. Arugan has got a wonderful program, and they do, you know, they go out and do literacy programs, which is also supporting breastfeeding for women. A lot of support for women and work, and helping women to combine their role of mothering and work. Malaysia, of the three ethnic groups of Malays, Indians and Chinese, the Malays have the highest breastfeeding rates, similar to Singapore. And the Malaysian government hospitals, I think, are now 100% of them are baby-friendly, and they're now starting work on the private hospitals. And that's been quite a quick transition, you know, in the last certainly 5 or 6 years that's happened. Vietnam, virtually all mothers initiate breastfeeding, with 99% continuing to breastfeed beyond 6 months. I don't have exclusive breastfeeding rates on that. There's been someone was asking about this before, they had an educational program on the value of colostrum, which is often discarded by Asian and Indian mothers, and basically the women in Vietnam are feeding their babies colostrum because they educate them. And I tell people that in Australia, because we have a big Vietnamese population, that you tell the Vietnamese women that the women back in Vietnam are feeding colostrum. The hospitals are being accredited baby-friendly, and they're also addressing the WHO code. The WHO code has been implemented into law. And that's actually just an example of a postnatal stress and depression information booklet in Vietnamese that we produced in Australia, because it was quite a problem. They wouldn't recognise depression in the Vietnamese community, so they had to call it postnatal stress, which was socially acceptable, and so very nice, and it's been a good program. Indonesia has very high breastfeeding rates but low exclusive rates. The companies tried to overturn a law against marketing follow-on formulas, claiming they're beneficial to the traditional breastfeeding culture. We did a lot of phone calls going backwards and forwards supporting our colleagues in Indonesia to try and get that stopped, which we did manage. They were basically, I think, paying a bit of money under the counter, and but it didn't work. In 2001, the first group of candidates passed the IPLC exam. There, I don't know how well you can see it on the left, is a picture from Borobudur, which is a World Heritage Buddhist temple, thousands of years old, I was walking through there, and there were these twins breastfeeding, so I took a photo. And that's a picture actually of breastfeeding down the bottom here on a Sumatran ferry. New Zealand, anyone from New Zealand here? No? Okay. Sir Frank Truby King had a profound influence on infant feeding practices in New Zealand and also Australia, and he reduced the infant death rate dramatically by teaching safe artificial feeding. He was supposedly a strong advocate of breastfeeding, but his ideas were unfortunately misguided and based on his veterinary background. And he had this sort of, you know, the clock face of 4-hourly feeding, similar to what Elizabeth was showing us this morning, and, you know, these little tables. And I mention these because I think, particularly I notice when I go to New Zealand, that they still have a tendency to follow schedules much more than probably we do in Australia. And I think it's that very strong heritage there. The New Zealand's Maori have a strong breastfeeding tradition that has largely been lost, and recent initiatives have seen the breastfeeding promotion actively incorporated into the Maori SIDS program, and that's actually going quite well. And there's some pictures from some very nice breastfeeding materials they've produced. They've got a very strong breastfeeding committee developed, and they're accrediting baby-friendly hospitals and really moving ahead very well. And, of course, La Leche League New Zealand's one of the long-standing league groups. And the World Breastfeeding Week Breastfeeding Art Competition, organised jointly by the Dunedin Breastfeeding Coalition and the Dunedin Arts Council, attracted entries from all over the world. It was advertised on the internet, and that's Barbie Breastfeeding Cowgirl was one of the entries. And that's a photo of a Samoan mother in New Zealand who breastfed her triplets exclusively for 5.5 months. I have to say they were something like babies 6, 7 and 8 or something. And she was at home, I think, in an extended family, and basically she sat and breastfed. And she had absolutely no question that she could do it. Papua New Guinea, 97% breastfeeding at 4 months, and most continue for prolonged periods. Bottles, teats and dummies are on prescription. There's rumours that infant formula is on prescription, and that's actually not true. Bottles, teats and dummies are on prescription, and they're quite hard to get. And I tell you what, if you can't get bottles, it takes all the fun out of bottle feeding. I mean, you know, if you've got to cup feed your infant formula or something, it's nowhere near as attractive. They didn't put formula on prescription because they were worried that mothers would just use regular cow's milk or something. So formula is available, but the mechanism to feed it is made more difficult to obtain. And working mothers get up to an hour of paid breastfeeding or expressing breaks for the first 6 months. Australia's breastfeeding rates, people say that they're very good. We're always struggling with them. The initiation rates are actually quite good, 87.6%. This is 5 or 6 years ago, this data. But there's a fairly rapid drop-off rate. 2 weeks or more, we're down to 77%, and then going down even further. About at 6 months, it's about half of breastfeeding. I think if we had more accurate data, we'd find that it probably has increased a bit in recent years. I think we are making inroads. Just a few pictures of people breastfeeding in various... We are, of course, a multicultural society, very like America in lots of ways, with lots of different cultures. I just want to briefly mention here Catherine Hospital, which is up, those of you who know your Australian geography, it's up near Darwin, which is right up in the central top of Australia, up the north. And Catherine Hospital, I had the great privilege of going up, it's a bit south of Darwin, to assess it for baby friendly a couple of years ago. And it was the most wonderful, wonderful experience. Most of the women that come there are coming from remote Aboriginal communities, and they fly them in at 36 weeks, and they live in a hostel on the grounds of the hospital, and then they have their babies there, and then they go home. And they usually come in with a support person, and then they go back home again when the babies are a couple of weeks old, I think. And breastfeeding is very much women's business. It's those traditional cultures. It was like looking through a window at how our ancestors breastfed. That was how I felt it was, because these are women who have never had breastfeeding messed up. And I spoke to midwives who'd worked at that hospital for 20 years, and the practice, I mean, they were being accredited now, but they could have been accredited baby-friendly 20 years ago. The practices hadn't changed. They'd been bedding in for 20 years and never had schedules, just, you know, wonderful breastfeeding practices. So just some pictures from there. Have I got... Yeah, once again, the SIDS program, they're using and they're incorporating breastfeeding promotion into that. The Australian Aboriginals, when they become urbanised, as with a lot of ethnic groups, they lose a lot of their cultural practices, including breastfeeding. So the breastfeeding rates, you know, they become the lowest socioeconomic groups in our cities, and their breastfeeding rates are lower than any other group. But the traditional communities are 100% breastfeeding virtually. I have to tell you that these babies, the interesting thing is we had to modify the assessment for those of you that know anything about baby friendly. They don't teach them about rooming in because they don't want to tell them that there is any alternative. They had to teach them positioning and attachment. And in fact, these women don't position and attach. And this was a real mind. I couldn't ask them their skills about this. Because the babies basically self-attach as newborns. The women sleep very deeply. They lie on their backs at night and they go to sleep. And this is like the day after you've had your baby or the night after. The babies are in bed with them and the babies basically self-attach and feed when they want to feed. The midwives say at about 6 o'clock in the morning they do a rounds and they fish out these milk and urine soaked babies out of the beds and they clean them up and they tuck them in bed with them. One of the questions on the baby friendly assessment is how often do you feed your baby? And I got some interesting answer. It was on a Wednesday and one of the women said to me, when I said how often do you feed your baby, she said, since Sunday. She was right, because those babies virtually never come off the breast. And, you know, you were talking about this before, that, you know, our milk is designed to basically to be frequent feeding or almost continuous feeding, and that's how they're feeding. And that's probably how our ancestors fed. And so one of them said that she breastfed since Sunday. Another one said that she breastfed twice a day. And I think actually, with a little bit of probing, she meant there was one feed in the night and then there was that period when the baby was actually taken away and cleaned up and given a bath and then there was the day feed. So that's sort of, you know, twice in 24 hours. And, you know, they were just on the breast all the time. That's a picture of World Breastfeeding Week, our breast fest in Hobart. We, in Australia, one of the things that we've been doing is going for the world record of breastfeeding, where you get the most women breastfeeding in one place at one time, and they're wonderful publicity stunts. The media loves it. We never have a chance of breaking the world record in Tasmania, where I come from, but we do it because the media all come out in droves and take photos, and it's all over the newspapers and the radio and television. Adelaide currently holds the record. Now, California somewhere. Berkeley got the most people, but Guinness Book of Records won't recognise your attempt because it wasn't recorded properly. Yep. So you're going to have to do it again, folks. Huh? Well, about 2 weeks ago, they were told they got the information from Guinness that they're not recognising it. And there's been some communication because of the way it was counted. I mean, I think you had more people breastfeeding, so. Okay, you're probably, August 9th, you probably grab the record then and keep it. And you can go onto the, you can go onto the web and search the Guinness site and you'll get, I think, the Sydney attempt. We have the Breastfeeding Coalition in Tasmania, and one of the things we developed was a TV community service advertisement aimed at encouraging people to think about their attitudes to breastfeeding in public. I've got a poster presentation upstairs with a little bit about this, and I've actually have got a supply of these posters. If you want to turn up at the poster presentation this afternoon, not all at once, sorry, I won't have enough, but I've got quite a fairly good supply. Can I keep going? At the post, I think later this afternoon there's a viewing time for the poster presentation, today and tomorrow, like 4:30 to 6 or something, is it? Up near the outside the exhibit hall, there's a whole lot of poster boards and the poster presentations are all up there. And you can look at some of the other activities the coalition's doing. We also have dietary guidelines in Australia, and actually they've just announced the revised ones, and breastfeeding's in there as the first dietary guideline for what you do, which is really good. We have a national breastfeeding strategy that the government gave $2 million for 9 major breastfeeding initiatives, and they tended put out for tenders for each of the projects, and Australian Breastfeeding Association managed 2 of the largest projects and they're involved in some of the smaller ones. And I'm just going to run through them very quickly just out of interest. Improving breastfeeding support for Indigenous Australians, developing a companion document to the infant feeding guidelines for health workers to assist health workers in providing consistent and practical breastfeeding advice for mothers. So this was a teaching aid. It was a whole lot of laminated sheets that you could, which were widely distributed. 20 attractive laminated fact sheets which could be used for teaching mothers. Developing national accreditation standards for maternal and child health services to address antenatal, childbirth and postnatal care, as well as infant care up to 12 months. And actually, I have to say very sadly that we had to battle to get breastfeeding in there properly, which I think wasn't so good. But that's supposedly being used as part of the baby-friendly accreditation is sort of linked in with that. National breastfeeding education and promotion to families, that was a project done by the Australian Breastfeeding Association, and particularly reaching out to a range of ethnic, cultural, young, low-income and low-literacy groups. And they developed some tip cards, which are in 6 of the most common languages in Australia. I'm going to give you a website address at the end, of this little bit, which I'll leave up from so you can write it down. This material is all available on the internet, and you can actually download it, the materials that were developed as part of this project, including these tip sheets in various languages. The low literacy materials and comic books for teenagers, which were actually very well received. There was a project encouraging employers to develop and implement policies and procedures, a guide to combining breastfeeding and work. Health professional education, the best practice guide to common breastfeeding problems, which was sent to every doctor in Australia, and a lactation resource directory. 3 clinical education and self-assessment modules, one for doctors, one for child health nurses and one for pharmacy assistants. An antenatal package, which was a handbook and a video for pregnant women. And combining breastfeeding and paid work, a booklet to raise awareness of breastfeeding issues and ways to continue breastfeeding. And then the last one was monitoring the developing national standard indicators, which have only just come out, actually. And there's the website, which is actually a bit complicated, but those of you that want to write it down. Everyone's still writing there. A lot of the materials are in PDF format, and you can just download a book or whatever. Read about the project. You all got it? Nope. People are still writing there. I think that's it anyway. I'll just come on. Oh, yeah. And that's the other part of the Asia Pacific. That's actually, it's not Antarctica. That's an elephant seal who landed on a beach just outside in Tasmania, where I live, just outside of Hobart. And she got a bit, they don't normally give birth anywhere near where we are, but she was young and it was her first baby, they seem to know somehow. And she gave birth, and they put barriers up so that people wouldn't disturb her. And every day we had a long account in the newspapers, usually on the front page, about seal lactation. It was wonderful. And it was very interesting. I mean, lots of things. And apparently, you know, she lies there and basically she virtually doesn't move, and she just feeds continuously for like 3 weeks or something, and then she just leaves. And the seals are then, you know, of course they're in a colony, so all the young seals are together. But this particular mother had the sense to stay and give her baby swimming lessons. And she took it into the water and she taught it to swim. She stayed an extra week or two and actually gave it all these lessons, and then eventually she did leave. And they were watching, and as soon as she left, they swooped and they put this baby seal, which was actually quite big by them, it's an elephant seal, into a sling, and they helicoptered it to Matsuka Island, where there's a seal colony, and put it with a whole lot of colleagues. So I think they've tagged it, and they are trying to keep an eye on it to see if it remains in the area. But it was just that picture was actually on the front page of the newspaper, and I went down and bought it because I thought it was a wonderful photo of a breastfeeding seal. Okay. There we are. I put that up in case anyone didn't get it. Any questions? Very high orphan population. I don't know. She said that she knows there's a very high orphan population, and do they get milk from the milk banks? I think the milk banks are only for the mothers in, you know, the babies that are in hospital, or, you know, like I think there are. I think the orphanages are using infant formula. And don't get me wrong, there is certainly infant formula in China, and it's actually quite a problem. There was a survey, and I think something like 20% of mothers had actually had direct contact by a formula company representative in a fairly small survey. So they're making inroads there, and they're battling against them. But I think in the orphanages they would certainly be. In fact, I'm certain they're using infant formula. A lot of the hospitals have high rates of baby friendly, but are they fulfilling the requirements? I think generally they are. One country, which I won't name for fear of shaming them, I know is basically saying, you know, you only have to implement 8 out of 10 steps in order to be accredited. And that's not the global standard. You've got to implement 10 out of 10 steps in order to be accredited. Most of them, I think, actually are pretty good. They're trying to do reaccreditations and reassessments. I know China's been doing some random reassessments. In Australia, we've actually put a time limit. When we accredit, we only accredit for 3 years, and then you have to be reassessed again. Basically, it runs out after 3 years, and you lose it, or you get reassessed and earn it again. And that's keeping them on their toes. It's actually very good. And there are, WHO and UNICEF have developed some reassessment criteria and ways of monitoring ongoing information. But I think, generally speaking, I think they're maintaining standards, although they do slip. I've been into baby-friendly hospitals that had formula company calendars on the wall of every mother's room. And you've got to be polite, of course, and then you quietly say something afterwards. Okay. When you're assessing a hospital, they've got to implement all 10 steps, but they, some of the assessment, you've got to pass the step at the 80% level. So if 80% of the mothers are fully rooming in, for example, then that would pass it. But what they're saying is, well, you've only got to pass any 8 of the total of 10 steps. So you could do no education, or you could have no rooming in, or, you know, one of these 10 steps and you'd still pass, which defeats the whole purpose. I have to say, there is something magical about the 10 steps. I think they are truly inspired, that when they come together, the whole culture changes. I mean, I've assessed a number of breastfeeding hospitals, and when all 10 steps come together and are properly implemented, there is a whole cultural shift. Would you? Yeah. It really is one. I love being in a baby-friendly hospital. You walk in the door and you just know, you know. I think it actually, it's probably the oxytocin, but you just know it's friendly. It feels friendly. The mothers are all blissed out on oxytocin, and the breastfeed, you know, it comes together. I very strongly believe in Baby Friendly. It's a wonderful initiative. Yes? Burma. Very little, other than that I believe they have a very high rate of home births, and they accredited their home birth program Baby Friendly. That was just a piece of information that I have. I think that they're reasonably good with breastfeeding, but I don't have a lot of information. Yep. So, Generally speaking, the Muslim communities have a higher breastfeeding rate because the Quran says that you should breastfeed for 2 years. They don't always do it, but generally speaking, that is an influence. If you're wanting to be a good Muslim, then you would breastfeed. And I think there's actually something that the husband's got to support. And in fact, I think the Jewish, the Torah says that too, doesn't he? That the husband has to support his partner to breastfeed for 2 years. The Hindus, I haven't actually seen comparative rates, although I do think Bali is probably lower breastfeeding rates. So it may be that there is a cultural difference there. Do you want to know about breastfeeding in Iraq? This is a little aside. The IBLCE has actually been supporting the development of lactation consultants in Iraq for some years as a just as a supportive sort of thing, and where because breastfeeding, the formula was virtually unavailable, and breastfeeding became a life or death issue, and of course there were a lot of health issues, and so they've had some quite good breastfeeding education programs. They've had some breastfeeding advertisements on television, a whole series of advertisements that they were running encouraging breastfeeding. They've got a number of lactation consultants there who are really supporting breastfeeding, some wonderful people who are just trying to get the women to breastfeed. And of course in recent times, that's probably, with the water supplies all interrupted and everything, it's probably has been a real life and death issue. So, and in Iran, they've got to have generic labelling on the cans. They can't put, brands. It's all just one generic government-issued label on the cans of formula. So the cans aren't inherently promotional, as our own cans are. No Peter Rabbits and... yeah. Okay, that was out of Asia-Pacific. Any other questions? Peggy.
It seems like when we hear all these stories that it goes back to some of the basic things that breastfeeding support gives women, and that La Leche League has demonstrated is good information and support. So in most of these countries, what they've done, it seems like, has been able to really increase the accurate information to mothers and to give that hands-on support that we know is so important. Do you have any other questions for any other of the participants? Because everyone really didn't get the same amount of questions. But, or do you... yeah, go ahead.
It's a UNICEF picture, that one, because the formula-fed babies basically get sick, but baby probably has had diarrhea its entire life, or infections. I mean, cholera, God knows what else, which just prevent, when you're using your body's energy, whatever energy is going in and staying in, to fight infection, you don't grow, basically. And that was what the... Okay. Yeah.
You want to come on? World. I know someone who knew that mother, and they didn't have enough money to buy formula, and she had been told over and over she would only have enough breast milk for one baby, and of course boys reign in that country. So she breastfed her son, and she watered down what little formula she could buy for her daughter, and her daughter died the day after that picture was taken.
Whoa.
What do we do with that information? Well, it is, so how do we start, really? All this progress that's been made in these countries is so encouraging, and we look at our whole country in the United States and wonder where to start. And maybe we just start where we are, in our communities, in our towns, in our states, doing the kinds of things that we've always done in La Leche League, is getting more information, more support. I think the story in Norway is encouraging, where we see the increase in breastfeeding. It seemed not because of policies or maternity leave, but again, as women got that correct information. So I think we go back and do the work we're doing, and I thank all of the presenters for being here and your wonderful stories, and thank you to all of you for all the hard work you're doing supporting breastfeeding all over the world. Thank you.